Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Today is the day that we have Nan Calvert with us in the studio, and I am very happy that she has brought along with her today someone who's been on the morning show with us before, I believe, Allison Thielen, who is back now with Root Pike Win, or Root Pike Watershed Initiative Network. And this is a group that works tirelessly here in southeastern Wisconsin to try and safeguard the well-being of the watershed, and to help the public understand the importance that the watershed plays in all of the ecosystems around us. And it's just not possible for us to have a healthy and sustainable environment if we aren't giving important attention to this. And so much of what we've done in terms of building up the modern world has actually compromised the health of the watershed. So there's a lot of different avenues and aspects of this that we need to be talking about. So we have an important conversation with us. Allison, what is your position exactly at Root Pike Win?
I'm the program manager.
Program manager. Well, it's good to have you here. And Nan Calvert, we welcome you back as well.
Well, thanks.
Nan, you go way back with Root Pike Win, I believe.
Yes.
Can you kind of tell us what this about this long history that you have with this organization or agency? I'm not even sure what we should call it.
Well, many, many moons ago, when Root Pike Watershed Initiative Network was just sort of in the beginning of their Rain Garden Initiative program, I worked with Root Pike Win as an advisor, but then I also worked as a field coordinator directly with the grant recipients to help get their rain gardens built and planted. Excuse me. And it was a very fulfilling thing to do, to watch people realize that what they did on their own properties, right in their front yard or their backyard, could have an enormous impact on water quality issues. And just by putting in a 300-square-foot rain garden, you could mitigate, you know, thousands, hundreds of tons of, or whatever, gallons of water, filtering it and letting it go back down into the ground where it was supposed to be, rather than running off as stormwater runoff. So that was a really fun and wonderful job to have.
And so when was that?
Oh, my goodness. How many years ago was that? That was
the Rain Garden Initiative began in 2008.
Yes. So not that many moons ago. But.
Right. Ancient history by some standards. Well, at any rate, it's of course, an issue and a concern that is not going away. So it's good that we can be talking about this today.
Mm-hmm.
Allison, if I remember Nan correctly, you've been a bit in and out of Root Pike Win yourself. Do I remember that you were part of the organization and now you're back?
That's correct.
Trace that for us, would you?
Yes. So I originally came on board with Root Pike Win in early 2013, again, as the program manager. And I stepped down from that position last summer, which was in July of 2015, and I spent 8 months as the executive director of the Eco Justice Center in Racine, which is a wonderful experience with a wonderful organization. But ultimately, I found myself back with Root Pike Win. They have a fresh and new, vibrant and very motivated executive director now, Dave Giordano. It's very exciting to work under him. So the two of us are kind of moving forward and trying to implement watershed plans and continue to get the word out about things homeowners can do to help reduce stormwater runoff on their own property.
Very good. Tell us what initially prompted your own interest in the environment and the natural world. I mean, is this something from the cradle that has been really important to you, or otherwise, at what point and under what circumstances did this start to become a really sort of ferocious interest and passion for you.
Yeah, I mean, you could say it was from the cradle. I think before I ever even knew that, you know, environmental issues was a term, you know, I grew up two blocks from Lake Michigan, and I would spend so much time down there in Racine. My mom's house had, I could take a quick walk for less than 5 minutes and sit along the lake shore. And I found as a child that I often felt the most like myself and the most at peace when I was in the presence of the natural environment, and particularly water. I loved the beach growing up. I've been able to watch North Beach and its restoration and see how, you know, when I was a child in the 80s and it was closed sometimes 40 days out of the summer, and then watch the City of Racine Health Department do their restoration down there with the dune communities and the English Street outfall wetlands and all the difference that it's made. And now we have, you know, we might have a closing one day, maybe 5 days maximum per summer down at that beach, and it's just beautiful. So I have a very close personal tie with that water body and, of course, all the rivers that feed into it.
Hmm. I was just going to say that my wife and I were down at Zoo Beach, which is, you know, kind of the northern end of the big main beach, but it's just a little more sequestered, not quite so heavily populated as the beach that's a little farther south. And it's actually a beach I'd never been on, and I'm not a big beach person, but I was so struck by its beauty. And I realized that there's probably a lot of us who are essentially perched right on the edge of this beautiful lake and have all of these wonderful beaches right in our backyard and just let them go by without thinking about them or visiting them regularly. I just realized that's a real shame that I need to rectify somehow. And I bet you run into a lot of people saying that.
Yeah, I don't think you're alone in that. I think that there are a lot of people who have grown up around here who may be kind of taking advantage of our freshwater resources, or at least taking them for granted, not even getting out there very often and interacting with their rivers or Lake Michigan. I know there's some educational programs in Racine that go on, and they're always amazed because they'll bring middle school students down to that same beach, Zoo Beach, for an educational field trip. And oftentimes they find that these kids that live right in the city of Racine, it's their first trip to Lake Michigan, and they're 13 years old already.
Wow.
So it's you know, it's something that we hope to continue to bring more awareness to the community about, and not only just to have them know of all the great recreational opportunities that we have, but just how precious these resources are and how important it is that we protect them for future generations.
Hmm. So tell us exactly what this organization, Root Pike Win, is. I mean, I kind of struggled for exactly the right nomenclature right at the top of the program. I mean, is this an agency of the government? Is this a nonprofit organization? Is this kind of a conglomeration of the two? What is the group sort of on that level before we even talk about what you do?
Sure, yeah. Root Pike Win is a 501c3 nonprofit organization. So we're not tied in with the government in any way, shape, or form. We certainly work along with municipalities as much as we can to help them along with their restoration projects they may be tackling, or to help them find projects that they could potentially do in the future, and also help them secure funding and for some consulting, things like that. But no, we're a nonprofit, and we simply work to protect, restore, and sustain the ecosystems in the Root Pike watershed.
Hmm. And so in that respect, then, you don't come at this concern, in a sense, with any authoritative clout. You don't get to sort of proclaim what people must do with the force of law. It's you are in the business of persuading people to care about some of these issues and maybe alter the way in which they live.
Yes, yes, you could say that. I prefer to use the word, we prefer to educate people so that they, in turn, change their behavior because they want to do the right thing. We're not an advocacy organization, so, you know, we're not found in, you know, government courtrooms or anything like that. But we do a lot of PR, we do a lot of education, we do a lot of networking and collaboration with either sometimes governments, but other times other organizations, institutions, places that are interested in the same issues that we are.
You should tell our listeners, because obviously they can't see it over the radio, but you should tell them what T-shirt you're wearing today for this interview.
Oh, yes. I am wearing a T-shirt that features Sparkles the Water Spaniel, and he is the spokesdog of the Respect Our Waters campaign. So we have been running this campaign. This is our fifth year. We have PSAs that run on popular Milwaukee television stations, and we our whole message is clean water is a matter of proper training. And so Sparkles, in his ads, he will try to train humans on things that they can do on their own property to reduce stormwater runoff pollution. And the methods he uses to train them are some of the same methods that we use to train dogs. So he'll like squirt them with a spray bottle or shake a can of coins next to their head or something like that. So
whatever it takes.
Yeah, it's amusing. He's very snarky and he's funny. So he's a good spokesdog and also helps us remember that dog poop is actually a big part of the problem.
Ah. For those of you just joining us, our guest on the morning show today is Allison Thielen, who is program director of the Root Pike Watershed Initiative Network, or Root Pike WIN, as they are affectionately known. And also Nan Calvert is with us. She's brought Allison here to the program today. And Nan has done a lot of work with Root Pike WIN over the years as well. So let's get a bit of terminology out of the way and explain to any of our listeners who aren't really clear exactly what we mean by a watershed and why a watershed is something that ordinary citizens need to know about and be concerned about.
Yeah, a watershed, it's a topographic area. So it's an area of land where all of the water that falls from the sky and hits it ends up flowing to the same place. And so, for instance, we could say the Pike River watershed, which the majority of that lies in Kenosha County. There's certainly a watershed boundary, and any precipitation that falls within that boundary eventually makes its way to the Pike River or one of its tributaries by way of runoff over the land, by way of infiltrating into the ground, becoming part of that watershed's ground table. Also, it simply could be due to storm sewers, putting the water right into the rivers. Typically, storm sewers don't go to any treatment plant or anything. They discharge right into the river. And then that river, of course, eventually makes its way into Lake Michigan.
Hmm. So what creates a watershed? I mean, what do you need in sort of the topography?
Yeah, well, I mean, a ridge, essentially. You know, if you hold your hand so that your knuckles make a ridge and you drop a drop of water onto your knuckles, it's going to go one way or another. It's going to either go down the back of your hand or it's going to go down the front where your fingers are. So that's kind of the watershed boundary model there is, you know, the water's got to go one way or the other, and everywhere is a watershed. It doesn't matter where you are. You're in some watershed. And so the water's got to go somewhere. It's typically the topographic features that that designate the boundaries.
Right. And I suppose there are some watersheds where even an amateur could probably get a sense of this is a watershed because you can just see in the topography that this is sort of a canyon or this is a valley or whatever, but it just has that feature. What about in the middle of Kansas or the middle of South Dakota? I mean, everywhere is a watershed, even if we don't see anything that would seem to indicate that?
Yes, everywhere is a watershed because everywhere there is generally precipitation and that water does head in one direction or another. Oftentimes, you know, it does take some aerial photography or, you know, GIS software or something to really determine where the boundaries are in the less obvious cases. But definitely anywhere you are, you're in a watershed. So there's something that needs to be taken care of in that watershed.
Right. And then when we're talking about, for instance, very hilly country or even mountainous country, then are we talking about very numerous watersheds all over the place because of that kind of complicated topography?
Yeah, I think complicated is a good word to throw in there because I think it depends upon the mountain range and it depends upon the topography and how many different water bodies there are that are either draining the water or that the water is draining to. So I think every situation is probably a little bit different, but it is something that's really interesting that I would encourage listeners to look up on the internet because you can look at maps with watershed boundaries and find out where you are.
Mm-hmm. So, for instance, in our watershed then, we have two main rivers, right? The Root Pike River and the Pike River?
Yes.
Are both within the same watershed?
Well, in the same watershed basin. And so the Root Pike watershed is actually five different watersheds that are all in the same basin. And so it's the Root River watershed, Pike River watershed, Pike Creek watershed, which mostly runs underneath the city of Kenosha. Then there's also the Wind Point watershed and Oak Creek watershed.
Oh. And all of them together form this basin,
yes,
which is like a grandpa watershed sort of thing, yeah, or what?
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of a conglomeration of these five smaller watersheds that are all in the same Root Pike Basin.
Mm-hmm. So what is it that is most important for a given citizen to think about in terms of understanding that geography? And I'm in this little watershed versus I'm in this big basin. I mean, or doesn't that distinction matter?
Well, I think the distinction of understanding where they are in the watershed is less important than the understanding that almost everything we do on our properties can have some impact upon the water quality in the watershed that you're in. So I think that's the more important factor, is, you know, realizing that they can take direct actions to impact the water quality in one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important, too, just for people to have a general understanding of just in general what is a watershed, and that everyone lives within a watershed. Everyone does. Whether you live in Oak Creek or you live in the Driftless area of Wisconsin, where perhaps you're not very close to a body of water. It doesn't matter if you can drive to a body of water conveniently or you can just sort of step out onto your porch and see Lake Michigan. Everyone lives in a watershed. And so things that you do on your own property will directly impact the water quality in your own watershed, even if you live far away from Lake Michigan and you live in the Lake Michigan watershed.
Is that one reason why you think it's important for us to talk about watersheds versus just water? I mean, everybody understands water and that we need water and we want clean water, but clearly you think there's something valuable to be gained by, in a sense, taking it one step further.
I think it's really important because it gives it an identity. It's not just water in general, which is essential and important, but it gives you an identity. This is the watershed within which I live, and this is what I can do to protect it. So, you know, when you think about, maybe Allison is going to bring this up later, but when you think about the difficulties that the city of Waukesha is having and the decision that was made about the Great Lakes Compact, and it looks as if we're going to start diverting water outside of our watershed to another community that's having great difficulties with their water quality and also quantity. Well, now, you know, it becomes a little bit more personal. It has an identity. The water in my watershed now is going to go elsewhere.
Right.
So what can I do to enhance the quality of the water in my watershed? And then at the same time, the people in Waukesha who are going to be, looks like they're going to be benefiting from the water in our watershed, what can they do to protect it? So.
So under the best of circumstances, how does a watershed function? I mean, let's imagine this watershed without sort of the interference of humankind and modernization, and we'll get to those specifics in a moment. But without all of that, let's say that would be ideal circumstances without any pavement, how would the watershed function? I mean, what is the ideal?
Sure, yeah. Well, let's say 150 years ago, before we had all of this development, and even before we had agriculture everywhere, typically, when it would rain in those days, about 4% of the precipitation would run off across the land into the streams. About half of it would evaporate, and the rest would soak into the ground and become part of the groundwater. Today, we've got about 35% of the water is running off across the land. And so there's much less that is evaporating or infiltrating into the ground. And so much more is running off simply because we have so many impervious surfaces. We have so many roads and roofs and driveways and sidewalks where the water can't soak in. So that's where we have the real issue of, you know, stormwater runoff and the water flowing across the land to make it to the nearest, you know, gutter, storm sewer, or river. And it's, along the way, it's picking up all types of pollutants from our yards and from streets and parking lots.
So is it a matter of us, in a sense, losing water, viable, usable water, or is it that we ultimately retain that water doesn't disappear, but that water degrades in quality? So is that the problem we're
talking about? It's the latter, yes, right. Water quantity is not an issue that we're looking at very much. It's more the quality of the water.
And just describe some of the typical pollutants that this runoff water will pick up.
Okay. Well, certainly there's the issue with, you know, agricultural runoff, and so we think of fertilizers and pesticides. Those things are also running off of our own properties when we're using them. Dog poop, as I mentioned earlier, is an issue. We've got certainly grass clippings and leaves in the fall are an issue. They may seem like organic matter, and they are, but they can be an issue when they're discharged into our rivers in mass quantities, and we can talk more about that later. Things like, you know, people disposing of their medications improperly can certainly affect the water quality, and also oil from cars. You know, we've all been in a parking lot and noticed that every single parking spot has an oil puddle, and when it rains, you can only imagine the amount of oil that's going to be washed into the storm sewers and directly into the lakes and the river.
So we're obviously not 150 years ago. We're living in modern America, and a landscape that we have dramatically transformed in some of the ways we've already talked about. So first of all, when it comes to building houses and building parking lots and so on, is there a way to do that that can be, in a sense, kinder to the watershed? And what are some of those ways?
Yes. I think with new development, that's probably the easiest time to, you know, put in some of these features that could help really reduce the amount of runoff that's happening. It's expensive to tear out your existing driveway and replace it with something else. But when you're building new, I would encourage people to consider things like permeable pavers for your driveway.
What is that?
Essentially, bricks with spaces between them. There's also, they make a special concrete now that is permeable that you could pour. It looks like any other concrete. And there's things you can do on your patio. You know, instead of having a large, you know, beautiful stamped concrete patio, you could use flagstone or lanninstone or something like that, which would have spaces between it with perhaps gravel to help that drainage happen. You could also, with your landscaping, putting in a new yard, use a lot of native plants. Some native plants have roots that go down, say, 20 feet into the ground, and they really help infiltrate a lot of that stormwater, much more than turf grass would. You know, most turf grass lawns have roots that are only an inch or two deep, so they're not able to create those little channels through the soil that really help the water infiltrate. And there are other things as well. Certainly, a green roof is something that would be great to see on homes. It's not very common on residential buildings, but it's something that's increasingly common on large buildings, municipal buildings, and things like that. But that's where you would have plants in special trays on a roof. Often they're succulent plants, and they simply drink up that water before it can even reach the downspouts of the building. And then it's not even running down the downspout. You could certainly install rain barrels on all of the downspouts of a new house. So there's lots of different things that you can do to help reduce stormwater runoff right away when building a new property.
Nan, your eyes always light up with the words of rain barrel, because that's something you know a lot about. And as we said earlier, you were part of kind of a special project with Root Pike Wind that involved that.
Yeah, we gave away a lot of rain barrels to people. It's interesting. I was just reflecting on what you were saying about living in these modern times. That's the beauty of it, because we have developed a lot of really terrific hardscape technologies, if you will, with permeable pavers and all kinds of other things. But in the olden days, you know, we used to use rain barrels all of the time. That was common practice. Rain chains are also helpful. If you live at a place where you don't have gutters, and there are still places that don't have gutters, rain chains help slow the cascade of water down to the ground, so you don't have this sort of eroded area at the base of a building. There are so many things that can be done. In the 70s, there were a lot of forward-thinking people who, instead of blacktopping their driveway or cementing their driveway, they used what looks like wooden lattice, except it's cement. And so in the openings, you can grow things, whether it's moss or grass or something else. You know, it's open and it's not running off. You know, we have rules in all of our subdivisions and places. You have to have a paved driveway, and it has to be blacktop. So two things. Think about how much water runs off of those that you don't even pay attention to, and how much evaporates because it becomes so hot. you know, it evaporates so quickly. It never has a chance to go back down into the ground. And I think, you know, there are places in Wisconsin that are rethinking how these things are done. Certainly out towards Madison, there are places like Willie Street Co-op that put in an enormous rain garden to help mitigate runoff from, you know, its commercial area. There are places like Seattle and Portland area that have actually redesigned their streets, existing streets, in order to capture runoff. And then underneath, there's a filtration system that cleans it before it's discharged. There are so many things that are happening now that can be done. And I think, you know, organizations like Root Pike Win and other watershed or water-focused organizations can offer so much to municipalities in terms of information and guidance about how to do this. Because none of us want to end up in this situation where our wells are drying up or our drinking water is contaminated or, you know, et cetera and so forth that we're seeing all across the nation. There are so many things that we can do to forestall that. And I think the other part of it is most people don't understand that the amount of fresh water available to us is very small comparatively. A lot of it is frozen, and we don't have access to it. Now, we know our ice caps are melting, and that's causing a loss of land. We have a lot of salty water, you know, and there are communities on the coasts that have gone to the approach of taking the salt out of the salt water in order to have enough water to do anything with. That's really drastic.
Right. And expensive.
And if we continue doing that, what impact is it going to have on ocean habitats? Because eventually it will have an impact, a negative impact. So there are so many things that everybody can be doing from a homeowner level to a town, a state, a region that can conserve water. And make it available to everybody for, you know, the foreseeable future.
For those of you just joining us, we are talking with Allison Thielen, who is the program director of the Root Pike Watershed Initiative Network, and Nan Calvert has brought her here. This is Nan's monthly visit to the program. Allison, what kind of studies or measurement does Root Pike Win engage in, if any, in terms of trying to assess what sort of the current state of affairs is and trying to measure in kind of careful ways versus educated guesswork on what's going on with the watershed? I mean, are there ways in which the health of a watershed can be quantified, I mean, and measured in that kind of way?
Yes, there certainly is. You know, over the past 6 years, we have done a watershed restoration plan for three of the watersheds that are in our basin. So the Root River, Pike River, and Wind Point watersheds all have a completed watershed restoration plan. As part of those plans, and to try to stick closely with EPA's guidelines for a watershed plan, we have had baseline water quality monitoring done throughout each of those watersheds during the planning process. And that way we have, you know, kind of, we can call it now historical water quality data that can be compared to when we're 5 or 10 years down the road, or when a major project has been completed that is, you know, estimated to remove a certain amount of pollutants from the watershed. We can then go back, you know, after it's been happened, and we can do the water quality monitoring again and see if it has made the difference that we hoped it would make.
And how do you go about doing that kind of assessment or measuring?
Yeah, well, we've actually contracted with the City of Racine Health Department Laboratory to do most of it. They're very well known for their ability to do this water quality monitoring. So they've got staff members that go out and take samples every single day. These are the same people that are doing water quality monitoring of our beaches to make sure that the water is safe for swimming. And so they're going and they're measuring for all different types of water quality indicators in the watersheds.
I'm curious about another kind of assessment, and that is how we are doing in terms of level of participation. Is that something that Root Pike Win keeps track of? I mean, like, how many rain barrels are in Racine County or Kenosha County, or what kind of alterations are being made in the way things are being constructed, for instance. I mean, I would assume on some level, at least, you are concerned about that and try to pay attention to that kind of thing. But maybe that's a difficult thing to assess.
Well, it can be difficult because there's so many different organizations and municipalities and individuals who are taking those actions now, which is a very positive thing. I do know that during the 4 years of our Rain Garden Initiative program that we were able to successfully install over 100 rain gardens throughout our basin, which is a great accomplishment. We also have been giving away rain barrels for years. Nan made me aware of that it was going on, you know, long before my time with Root Pike Wynn. And even during my time with Root Pike Wynn, we've given away over 150 of them. And oftentimes the folks who receive them, whether they win them in a free raffle or they attend a workshop and get a rain barrel out of it, they'll come back and they'll call me and they'll ask for, you know, advice or guidance on exactly how to install it, which is encouraging because you can own a rain barrel but not install it, and that certainly doesn't help anything.
Right.
Other than that, you know, we do have these three watershed plans completed that I mentioned, and each one of them contains a prioritized project list. And so these different restoration projects of all different types, whether it be wetland restoration or stream bank restoration, erosion control, all kinds of things like that, they're prioritized according to how serious the issue is in that particular area, how critical it is that project be completed. And what we're trying to do right now is look at all the projects that are listed in these plans and track them and talk with the municipalities and the landowners and find out perhaps if some of these projects have already been started or what are the municipalities planning on doing in the future, and can we jump on board with them and help guide them to the areas that are most critical to restore. And so we've certainly got, you know, a database tracking all of the activity that's going on.
Wow. I wonder about the technology of rain barrels. The very term suggests it's something pretty simple and probably not electronic. I'm guessing it's essentially the same kind of thing that's existed for a long, long time. But exactly how do they work? And is there more to it than meets the eye?
There can be. So a rain barrel is typically a container, any clean container that's 50 gallons or more, that is then has a spigot attached to it. And oftentimes it's very simple, where it's an old, big blue food barrel. And someone will simply cut a big chunk out of the top of it and lay screen there, and then cut off their downspout right above where the rain barrel sits and simply let the water dump into the rain barrel. And that's probably the simplest way to install a rain barrel. You certainly need to have it elevated off the ground at least 16 inches so that you get some type of flow from gravity out of there. Another way to install a rain barrel, which is a little bit more advanced but has some benefits, is to use a diverter kit. And so in that fashion, you don't need to chop off your downspout. You can have it go all the way down to the ground as it normally would. But then there is a tube that connects from the rain barrel to the downspout. And what happens with the diverter system is the water will flow into the rain barrel. But once the rain barrel fills, which during a really heavy rain can happen pretty quickly, the water will begin to back up through that tube and into the downspout. And that kind of flips a little mechanism that allows the water to then go down the downspout like it normally would to prevent the rain barrel from overflowing. So that's just a little bit more advanced system of a rain barrel. Regardless, you're going to get, on average, about 1,300 gallons of free water per season here in Wisconsin if you use a rain barrel. So if you have multiple rain barrels, that can add up to be quite a bit. It's free water. It's natural water. It's recommended for use on almost anything except possibly vegetable gardens. And the only reason that it's not a good idea to spray directly on your vegetables is because that water's coming from your roof. There are probably birds hanging out up there. You don't exactly know what type of bacteria could be introduced into that water just from, the critters that are up on your roof. But you can use it to wash your car, to water other types of gardens, your lawn. My kids even use it to rinse off their feet after they've gotten out of the kiddie pool, and I don't want them tracking grass clippings into the house.
Yeah.
So things like that. There's not a lot of water pressure that comes out of a rain barrel, so it's very good for filling up a watering can, or sometimes even a soaker hose that's not too long. But some folks get really excited about their rain barrels and they want to beef them up so that you can buy these small pumps that you can install onto the rain barrel. And that will allow you to actually be able to spray with a hose right out of the rain barrel. So there's different options.
Very good. So then it's a matter of one way or another just getting the water out of there and using it however you see fit then.
Right. And it's great to have that water source during the times of drought when we haven't had rain for a while.
Right. No kidding. What about farmland and farmers? Because you mentioned the fact that when we think about a more pristine watershed, it's not just before all these big buildings got built and all these cement parking lots got paved, but you also mentioned before widespread agriculture, the watershed behaved in a different way. What is it that farmers potentially can do to aid in the health, if that's a way to think about it, of our watershed?
Yeah, well, certainly over the years, farmers have installed a lot of drain tiles to drain what was formerly wetlands on their property. So, of course, you know, breaking any of those drain tiles and letting land be restored back to wetland is always great for water storage and can actually help reduce flooding in their farm fields that they might be experiencing. A lot of rivers or small streams, tributaries that are running through farmland have been ditched or channelized throughout the years, simply to make things easier for the farmer to channel the water away from his property as quickly as possible. And there's been some adverse effects of that over the years. You know, when water hits those very straight channels, it flies through there with tremendous force and causes there's a lot of erosion going on. There's a lot of sediment deposit going on. Hmm. And because of the speed, it's carrying pollutants into the watershed even faster than it would. And most farm fields, you know, are laden with fertilizers and possibly pesticides. And so those things are being carried into the water. Hmm. Another thing that they do often is they plow. At least historically, they plowed right up to the banks and tried to farm the land right up to the banks. And so now we've learned, you know, to have, say, a 30-foot buffer of native vegetation between the farm field and the riverbank can filter most of the pollutants out of that stormwater as it runs from the farm field to the stream.
Interesting.
Also, living in a rural area, it's very common for farmers in the springtime when things are melting and the soil is warming to broadcast all of that collected manure onto the fields. And if the soil isn't warm enough to accept the thaw and the manure, where does it go? Well, it just runs off. And, you know, there are times that the DNR will issue sort of a moratorium, if you will, don't broadcast manure on your land yet. However, it does happen. With regularity. And so I think, you know, farmers in our area, we have such a short growing season and they are under a time pressure to get things done. But broadcasting tons of manure over your land has a direct impact on water quality issues.
Mm, I should imagine.
So,
wow. It was interesting, Allison, what you described about, you know, how a farmer might carve something in their land to get rid of the water as quickly as possible. That, I mean, one can understand how one would do that. And on the other hand, in a sense, that's exactly what you don't want to do because you are creating the situation, the conditions under which that water will naturally travel quickly. And I guess maybe by the law of physics then, that's a bad thing for the water to be moving quickly.
It is, yes. I mean, that causes all, you know, lots of erosion issues. And, you know, that's kind of the old way of thinking is, you know, stormwater engineers in the 50s, 60s, their whole job was to take these neighborhoods that were having flooding issues and to build gray tunnels to simply get the water out of there as quickly as possible every time it rained. And now we have this new mindset where stormwater is being regarded as more of a resource than a nuisance. Mm. And it's being managed where it falls and these, you know, natural hydrological processes they're being mimicked and recreated so that we can really let nature process that stormwater and manage it where it falls, keep it there, or at least release it much more slowly into the watershed.
Right. Nature processing the water brings to mind something you've talked about a couple times, and we'll certainly let Nan chime in on the matter of native plants. So what is it about native plants that's so magical that they can play a really crucial role here? I mean, what's the difference between a native plant and a non-native plant that would make such a difference when it comes to this issue?
Sure. You know, native plants grew up here. So, you know, they lay down their roots very deep. Native plants do not require any fertilizer In fact, sometimes they're harmed by fertilizer because they're so well adapted to the soils that they're growing in. So you don't need to add those additional pollutants to a native plant garden. As I stated before, you know, those roots are so deep that they're really going to help infiltrate water. Non-native plants are more, you know, they're invasive plants. Not all of them are invasive, but they're ornamental. They typically have shallower roots. They also are not a natural part of our local ecosystem. So they're not going to attract the native birds and butterflies and bees and things that are also so crucial to our entire ecosystem that the native plants are going to attract.
It's in the roots.
In the roots.
Right. So it's interesting because when you go to a prairie or some, you know, open land native planting, you see all this glorious color and all the insects and birds. But what you don't realize is that underground, there's this amazing thing happening, and their root systems can go down to 14, 15, 16 feet underground. And there's this dense root community. All of these plant roots are interconnected. And about a third of that root system dies back every year, and then eventually it's replaced. So, but once that root material, that root tissue dies, it enhances the soil. But then what happens is that all of those roots, regardless of their size or their depth, they create channels through which water runs as it infiltrates back into the ground where it's supposed to go to begin with. All of this runoff is completely unnatural. It just is a byproduct of what we've done. So therefore, you know, velocity is slowed and also volume, but the quality is enhanced because it filters the water as it goes back down underground into the aquifers. And then eventually, you know, it's the water cycle that we all learned about at some point in time. All that water eventually makes it up to the surface again. And you know, we see it in streams and rivers and lakes and ponds and so on and so forth. Some ponds are not spring-fed, some are ground-fed. But anyway, that's a whole other subject. Mm. But anyway, it's all connected. And so when you use native plant communities instead of non-native plant communities, you get the added benefit of direct participation in what the water cycle is supposed to be.
Mm. And so these roots are, among other things, in a sense, breaking up the soil. The soil isn't just this solid brick off the top of which the water flows. I mean, it gives the water a chance to really soak in deep and ultimately become part of the, I suppose, the water table.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Which is where we ultimately want a lot of our water to go.
Yes.
Yeah. We just have a couple minutes to talk about one other thing that you've mentioned in the course of the conversation, Allison, and that is wetlands. If you can, briefly explain the role that wetlands play in all of this.
Yeah, wetlands serve as, you know, they're a natural ecosystem of themselves, and they serve to store a lot of stormwater. So they certainly can take on water, and they can store it there for a period of time, slowly releasing it into the watershed or into the nearest stream. And as they're doing that, there's native wetland plants that are filtering the water, much like these other native prairie plants would do that are just not in, you know, hydric soils. And so they're providing areas where water can, I guess, hang out to get clean.
Hmm.
Yeah.
That is probably the hardest thing for me to understand, just scientifically, how that happens. That almost seems mystical, and I'm sure it's completely scientific, but that doesn't make as much obvious sense to me as everything else that you've described. I mean, and I think most people, you know, just don't understand sort of the remarkable system that a wetland represents.
I think wetlands are the least understood ecosystems because we all think, well, it has to have water, I have to be able to see it, and it has to be there all year for it to be a wetland, but that's completely untrue.
Right.
It has to do with the amount of water in the soil. It has to do also with the plant communities that live there because it's all a community. It's all about relationship.
Right.
I know I say that almost every time I'm on the show, but it's really true. So think of a wetland as a sponge and imagine spilling an enormous amount of water in a quick period, in a short period of time. Wetlands act like a big sponge to soak up that water and say, okay, now you're not going to, you know, wipe out this whole community now because I'm going to hold on to you. And eventually you're going to, some of it will evaporate, some will go into the plants and animals, some will go back down into the ground. Wetlands are sort of like the kidneys of the earth.
Hmm.
They hold, they filter, they discharge. And unfortunately, because so much of our wetland systems have been destroyed, coupled with so much impervious surface and rerouting of waterways and all kinds of things, we see so much flooding and so much erosion and all kinds of other things. So if we can be involved in protecting our existing wetlands, but also be involved in restoring what wetlands we can, we will do a whole lot for our communities in terms of water quality issues and also lessening the threat of flooding. Allison was talking about, you know, the volume and velocity of water. That's why we get flash flooding. Our rivers and streams can't handle all of that runoff from all of the impervious surface. When you get a huge downpour in a short amount of time, whoosh, there it goes. And they just don't have time and the capacity to handle it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And we even see, you know, when MMSD has to discharge water into Lake Michigan because of the amount that's running into there through the stormwater sewer systems. Yes, it's all contaminated, but there are different ways to do things, and we really have to especially be involved at the grassroots level, getting our municipalities, our communities to, you know, think about upgrading our systems and modernizing our systems, thinking really about the future.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what Root Pike Win is all about, isn't it? And you, Allison Thielen, as program director, of course, lead the charge in trying to broaden our collective understanding of this. If people want more information about Root Pike Watershed Initiative Network and what you're doing and what they can do to be part of this effort, what can they do?
People can visit our website at rootpikewin.org. If homeowners are looking for tips on things that they can do personally to help reduce stormwater runoff on their property, they can visit respectourwaters.org. Most people might think that if they simply install one rain garden or one rain barrel on their property, that it's not going to make a big difference for water quality overall. But if many people take these steps, cumulatively it can make this huge difference for water quality.
Very good. Allison Thielen, Program Director for the Root Pike Watershed Initiative Network, it was great to have you here. Thank you so much for sharing such important information to us.
Thank you for having me.
And Nan Calvert, thank you for bringing Allison here and for making helping create yet another interesting program. Let's turn to the calendar events.
All right. So much is happening in September and also October. On September 15th, Sierra Club Southeast Gateway Group, our favorite Sierra Club chapter, will be hosting Tyler Huebner, Executive Director of Renew Wisconsin. That will be happening at the IMET at 6:30 p.m. For more information, just go to the Sierra Club Southeast Gateway website. On September 17th, Seno Conservancy will be having its Woodland Festival featuring a barn dance and pig roast from 1 p.m. till 9 p.m. For more information and to register for dinner, call 262-539-3222. On September 18th, Racine Dominican Eco Justice Center will be hosting its annual fall festival with all the same fun and food and great energy and music that they usually have from 11 a.m. until 4 p.m. There is a fee. Just go to their website for more information. On September 24th, from 7 a.m. until 3 p.m., Hoy Audubon will be hosting the Big Bird Sit. That will be at Sam Myers Park from 7 a.m. until 3 p.m. It's free. It's open to the public. You can just show up, but if you need more information, again, give them a call or go to their website. And finally, on October 1st, Seno Conservancy will be presenting the first ever Rolling Vista Ride. It's a cycling event for all, regardless of your cycling ability. For more information, call 539-3222. Lunch will be included. And that's it.
Thank you, Nan Calvert, and we look forward to seeing you next month on The Morning Show.
Thank you.
I'm Gregory Berg. We'll be right back. Monday on the morning show, you'll hear my conversation with historian Julie Fenster, whose new book is called Jefferson's America, The President, the Purchase, and the Explorers Who Transformed a Nation. As you can maybe gather from the book's subtitle, the book is mostly about the Louisiana Purchase and the way in which our nation was so dramatically reshaped. On Tuesday, we're going to be learning about Kenosha's historic and beautiful manor house. On Wednesday, Art Sear joins us. On Thursday, a number of award-winning cartoonists from the country, across the country will be in Kenosha for yet another